to the Mug Meeting Summaries podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our September meeting started with the usual roundtable discussion, moderated by Doug Shufelt.
Any comments, points of interest that happened over the summer?
Here's a bit of a comment. I have from the mailing list. You know, I've got a G4 server box that I was trying to get up and running latest software. Well, thanks to a number of people, I found that there is a solution if you want modern software instead of the stuff coming with OS 10, 10.4, which is way out of date. That's to use Debian for the PPC. Everything is as up to date as any Debian.
Sorry. What was the question?
Oh, it was the comment.
It was a comment.
That explains why I didn't hear a question.
Sorry.
Good comment. Any questions? Since Adam is eager for questions.
Just so I understood what you're saying there. Are you saying that, like, what kind of software is it you're talking about? Like server software,
desktop software, basically. And this is something that Mark Jenkins was doing with a bunch of his buddies. It's basically what he refers to as liberating Macs. Mm. Sort of getting them away from OS 10 and the Mac software specifically. So essentially, if you've got a good piece of hardware, I mean, the machine itself is decent. I mean, it's got good stats compared to a lot of the stuff that we've seen through recycling. I mean, it's no sense in chucking it out because, you know, you're stuck with, say, Apache 1.3 and PHP 2. Mm. You know, just install Debian on it. Yeah.
Just to give bit of background on it. It used to be that a lot of the major Linux distributions supported the PowerPC architecture, but now that there are so many fewer PowerPC machines out there and on the market, that Apple switched several years ago now, there are fewer and fewer distributions that have a current up-to-date version of Linux for the PowerPC. And then various have been dropping them over the years, and Debian still has something which is useful if you have those kinds of machines capable.
I feel compelled to add that most of the BSDs support PowerPC quite well also. The one big limitation you find with running non-OS X on a G4 server, this is the rack mount or the tower?
The mini tower.
Oh, okay. The rack mounts in particular, none of the Linux distros fully support the environmental fan management chip, so it either runs too slow and your CPUs cook, or most of them default to the more sensible option of run the fans full blast all the time, and then you basically have to build a bomb shelter around it to not go nuts because of the noise. The G4 towers, I think, mostly are supported as far as that goes. The rack mount units are not. Other than that, it works great though.
Well, that was a showstopper.
Tweet, 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 tweet.
Steve Jobs is not dead.
Yet. Okay, nobody else?
Too much time at the lake over the summer, I guess.
Apparently.
You guys are all rebooting, right? Just keep us
there. Oh, another comment then. How's this? Mint 11? On the Dell GX series does not work very well, so at the lab we've gone back to Mint 10. It's a multimedia version of Ubuntu.
Okay. What doesn't work well?
Essentially, it will. Some machines won't install. Other machines will install, but as soon as you restart the machine, you get this weird graphic problem where it doesn't redraw properly. So you end up with big black squares where the mouse is, and in order to refresh Windows, you got to move them around. Provided you know where they are.
And it's very specific. It's just Dell.
The Dell's GX series, but apparently the Dell laptops work beautifully.
GX 270s?
270s, 280s.
With integrated onboard video?
Yes, and sometimes even with a video card.
Oh.
Not often.
That's weird.
It was an option. You could get it and make hardware disabled.
Weird.
Apart from that, on the IBMs works beautifully. Well, at least on the IBMs I work. Roy's had a different experience.
I'm pretty sure the GX series uses shared memory for the video. Mm. So it could be that the OS and the video card both may get control of that memory.
Probably.
No, I haven't had a problem with, I haven't tried putting 11 on anything, but general experience is with the IBMs, there are some that will not accept an install disk, just never finds it. But if you put Linux onto a hard drive and stick it in, it works fine. You just can't do a direct install, and it'll never see that disk.
Actually, that just reminds me of, sorry, something else that I've heard of recently. I think VMware, the new version of VMware, was the first major product to be hit by this. But systems that have SATA hard drives and IDE CD-ROMs are now starting to have problems with modern installers. The release notes for VMware ESX5 state that if you have a Dell PowerEdge server, any Dell PowerEdge server, you cannot install the OS from a CD with the internal CD-ROM drive. But a USB CD-ROM drive works great. And any other installation technique works great. It just, the IDE attached CD internal to the machine doesn't work properly.
Where's the problem? Is it the driver is not supported or something?
The installer, which could be, I don't know, the kernel, the driver, something about the installation environment doesn't support reading from the CD-ROM after it's initialized the hard disk drivers.
Sorry.
Or something like that.
Okay, I got some. Has anybody else used NVIDIA Optimus at all? It's their new laptop thing where they actually shove Intel onboard graphics and an NVIDIA chipset on the same board, which works great if your drivers can switch between them in runtime switches between them. I've noticed for Linux, I actually hard lock my computer if I have that enabled, and basically the chipset switches, and then the kernel goes, or the X server, I should say, goes, I don't know what the hell to do, and just locks up hard. I can't get you any of the terminals even. The way around that is to use only NVIDIA in the BIOS, but I was wondering if anybody else used successfully both of the chipsets. Yeah, but I've noticed there's a couple different ones, like Bumblebee and stuff, that are basically trying to do it based off of the Nouveau stuff. No? Okay, I'm just screwed up.
That's probably too new. Just wait another 6 months to a year and people might have answers for you. you're the first, probably.
Can you use the BIOS to just lock out?
You can specify which one you want to use in the BIOS or both. And either one, you can specify the Intel chipset, and it works fine with Mesa. And if you use the NVIDIA one, you just need to have the NVIDIA kernel one.
Apparently there's a project called Ironhide that is the successor to Bumblebee, which tries to support this under Linux.
Okay.
And it looks like it has very active development.
Okay.
Translation, bleeding edge, and will probably still hardlock your system.
Still don't use it at work.
Do you think your battery life is really suffering because of it?
It does. With this particular laptop, I can literally go for about 8.5 hours on the Intel onboard. NVIDIA, because of even running run the NVIDIA kernel module, it still has the thing turned on, and it'll cut my battery down to about 3.5-4 hours.
Wow.
So almost double. And if I run it under Windows with Optimus, it still lasts for about 8, unless I'm doing something crazy.
Yeah, I am trying. I have a i7 workstation that has an Intel motherboard in it. It's DQ or something or other motherboard. The problem is, what I'm trying to do is I'm using QEMU KVM to do virtualization, and according to the directions, I am supposed to be able to, with this chipset and this motherboard, use VTD and dedicate PCI device directly to a virtual machine. And it's supposed to work, and it sounds really reasonable. And the problem I have is, even though Intel, all the information from Intel says it's VTD capable, the BIOS option is not there. Then I discovered that these newer BIOSes include a distributor or integrator's mask where they can turn off BIOS options and you never even see them in the BIOS. And these things will persist against even after a BIOS upgrade. It's a thing called the Integrator's Toolkit, ITK, and you can go out and turn these off. So I thought, well, maybe my integrator had turned this off to protect it. Supposedly you do it for sensitive settings in a corporate situation, or to protect your naive users from dealing with BIOS settings that might potentially cause fires and or other damage. So I thought, well, maybe my friendly and helpful integrator had turned these options off, and I went through this process of downloading this stuff. And the toolkit only works in Windows to get the basic stuff, but then you can build a DOS bootable USB or whatever with a DOS version of the tools to go out and change these masks and look at what's there. So I thought, well, maybe they turned off the VTD option because the vendor, that being Red Hat in this case, support, told me I have to specifically make sure this is turned on in the BIOS and the VTD, not just VTX, right? This is VTX capable, virtualization there is working just fine. And I can get the OS to detach the device from the host, but I cannot make the VM ever actually see it. And I wondered if anybody has any experience with KVM, QEMU, with attaching PCI devices directly to a guest VM. And has you ever got it to work?
Mm-hmm. What's your i7 chip number, you know? 93 something, 86? Is it a 3-digit or 4-digit?
4.
Because I know in the i5, they have... Now Intel's come out with, like, you know, there's 500 different SKUs of i5. Little number change means you don't get VT whatever.
Right.
Number
and,
change
and
means
I
you don't get this.
I went through both the motherboard version, which it's an Intel motherboard, and the chip, the CPU chipset, and the chip for the CPU. Both of them are supposed to be completely capable of VTD. And yet, I cannot get the Linux kernel to recognize it's there. There's a couple of messages that come out at boot time in D-message that tell you the kernel's actually recognized that it's VTD capable. I cannot get those messages to come out. I've gotten nowhere with this. I would really like to have it because I have a spare video card in this machine, and I really want one of the virtual machines to be able to use it because it's my freaking desktop. And it's a really nice video card. And I want my desktop to be on one of these VMs and protect some other VMs in there from accidents. Like me.
I haven't done it with QEMU or Xen, but on the VMware side of the world, VTD is, of course, fully supported. VMware specifically cautions that, you know, VTD may be supported by your CPU, may be supported by your BIOS, may be supported by your chipset, may be supported by everything. And then here are, like, the 8 motherboards we've ever tested where it worked.
Okay. I wondered that's the case because they also had a lot of caveats in there about the particular PCI card itself, whether it would be able to fully capable as well. I tried it with the onboard graphics I've dedicated to the host VM. It's got an add-in card that I wanted to give to the virtual machine. I also tried it with one of the Nix, because Red Hat support suggested, well, why don't you try it with just one of the network interfaces, which is a little bit easier and more chances of success than working with a video card, because of the way RFQs work with video cards. It's not as simple to work with a video card at that level as is a standard NIC and its IRQs. Neither one worked, and that's when I found out that this supposed BIOS option is not visible, and I thought it was really stinky. I really, you know, as somebody that works with this stuff, I don't like them. I mean, the BIOS used to be your last bastion to find out what the hell is going on in here, and now you can't even trust it because it just will not even show you the options that are there. So you have to go through this other extra step to try to reveal what's been done to it. And if the integrator doesn't change the logo, which you have to actually, when you do use that toolkit, you have to take an extra step to actually make it visible that you even had an integrator modify the BIOS. Right? This one, fortunately, said that they put their name in there. They didn't change the splash logo, which you can do. You can change the BIOS splash logo entirely if you want to do that with graphics and everything. They simply put in the character strings that showed up if they had modified it.
I don't remember.
Apparently, even the guys at Red Hat, we went over the same with a fine-tooth comb, and everybody says, well, it should. I haven't actually contacted Intel themselves and said, you know, why isn't it, you know?
Is this a performance design brand board?
Yes, it is.
Forget it. Just forget it now. It'll never work.
But
the particular motherboard that they chose, this is one of the U of M bulk purchase models.
It's not a bulk purchase. See, that was the funny thing. I was going for a bulk purchase because I wanted a very standard one, but I wanted a couple things added on, with one of which was 4 terabyte SATA drives, so they couldn't use their standard motherboard. So they got this. Intel calls it an executive class motherboard, and it's a much better motherboard, and they had to put it in a gaming case to hold all the hardware out. It was a pretty case with nice fans and all that, and it's very quiet, actually. That's one thing nice about a good gaming case for a tweet drive. They're very quiet, because I'm not doing gaming, so... And I haven't got my VM to actually do anything really seriously useful to heat the thing up yet.
You updated the BIOS, right?
Yeah, I've clashed with the latest and greatest BIOS and, you know, tried everything. But I was really curious about VTD, if it actually is working for anybody.
Most likely you run into the same sort of stuff that I've run into with Intel brand motherboards, where... Yeah, it's supposed to support a given feature. They just never bothered implementing it in the BIOS. Like, I had a motherboard. There was a Pentium 4 board, and I had a Pentium 4 chip that supported hyperthreading. And there was the version of the BIOS I was on didn't support hyperthreading. Then there was a version that did, and then the final version of the BIOS disabled it again.
We discovered that supporting really wasn't working.
That was why. They discovered that the system wasn't 100% perfectly stable with that option turned on, so they just took it back out.
Well, so, thanks. You know, that could be my case. I haven't actually tried regressing the BIOS back, because I think this design is maybe a year or two old, so maybe it didn't pan out, and they just flat disabled it in a later BIOS. It was only like one step behind when I got it on the BIOS, and so putting the new one on didn't help. So maybe... if I can dig around and find an old one, I might have an unstable.
But the other thing they do, as Trevor well knows, is they basically hold back features on the desktop boards and reserve them for the workstation boards.
Yeah, but his should have a DQ45.
Yeah, it's a DQ67.
Oh, 67?
Yeah. And, you know, it's a higher-end board, but it didn't seem quite good.
But you might have hoped they might come up with another BIOS version. Sometimes 6 months, 8 months later, they finally fix stuff up to the point where it's where you want it. So just keep watching the Intel site and the firmware upgrades.
Well, I mean, I'm now willing to get a hold of Intel. I mean, somebody's seen or heard of this actually working at some point. Maybe, you know, it's worth getting a hold of them and saying, you know, this one doesn't work.
Well, their forums, their community forums might be a good place.
I did that. But I wasn't willing to go start a new thread and go through the work of monitoring and all that stuff.
Yeah, you might have to do that.
It was probably going to be fruitless and just something that you really need to spend a hell of a lot more money to get those kind of features.
Well, one thing about Intel is when they put out new BIOS versions, they actually listen to the complaints that people have put in about that board. So if you find a channel where you can lodge a complaint and say, you know, I bought this board to get this feature, and this feature isn't there, I can't turn it on, there's actually a non-zero chance that it would show up in a future BIOS rev.
Okay.
Not a great chance, but non-zero. One over and over.
They almost got struck by lightning once.
Yes.
On a related note, I've also had similar problems trying to write programs that use pthreads to use several CPUs concurrently. And I recently upgraded to an i7 that has hyper-threading, so it gives you sort of in virtual double the amount of CPUs you would ordinarily have for various tasks. And the problem is getting documentation for writing programs. I finally found stuff, but it had errors in it. Some of it was from IBM, which I should maybe complain, but... there are various stuff that was written years ago. It might be just that it's out of date and it doesn't work on a given system or platform the way it once did, probably. Is there any stuff that is up to date, you know, the most recent stuff for parallel threads? Even stuff that's in assembly, I would be grateful to get a hold of. I looked at some assembly routines in there, and it's basically spin locks and calls to various addresses and so on. It's not user-friendly, but do they have anything designed for that other than C? Anybody?
Pthreads are user-land-based in Linux, so you're only going to get whatever processor affinity
anything
is assigned to that process, that particular process. So don't expect, to run on every single core, and I use that term loosely. Look at K-threads. That's essentially kernel-level threads, so that would be a one-to-one mapping. And some implementations, like the libsmp, that kind of stuff, will do one-to-one mapping. In terms of how to properly use them, take a look at some old Sun stuff on green threads. They have some really good documentation on with respect to pthreads and the various styles of libraries around. I would check that out. But doing SMP in assembly, not so good. And it's not because it's hard to do or nobody can do it. It's just that with modern processors...
You want it to be POSIX compliant, so to speak.
Not really. It's mostly due to tricks to make memory reads faster, and you don't know them all. Like, even GCC doesn't know them all.
Really?
Yeah.
I read some stuff on NUMA and little memory allocation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with that.
Yeah, like for instance, if you have a quad core processor and one bank of memory, there's a special instruction called an IPI or interprocessor interrupt. It behaves differently on a core than it would on a different socket, and it gets very hairy at that point. Because the newer server-level Intel boards, so you can get like 4-socket, 10-core per socket, but each socket has its own memory. So take a process and then have its memory on a different socket, and then you see your nice 40-core machine operate.
Like a
2-core machine.
It's not just the memory-related things going on there. It's also that the processors... now do instruction reordering and things like that.
Yeah, that's where the hyper-threading comes in.
Your compilers understand how to write code that will cooperate with that reasonably well. Where if you're handwriting assembly code, you're not going to be working on the same assumptions that the compiler is and that the processor is.
Yeah.
Well, I'd go a step further than that, and I'd say if you're doing multi-threaded programming, you should stick to pthreads, but you should switch to the Intel compiler, not GCC, and you should switch to the Intel threading library, which is pthreads compatible but optimized for Intel CPUs. Well, unless, of course, you're not using Intel processors, in which case, forget what I just said.
I tried it on both. Years ago, I had AMD dual core, and now I've got the iMac with hardware hyper-threading. So it's like quad core with 8 virtual cores. I'm kind of interested in the hyper-threading aspect. Does anyone know any where I can get tutorials or anything on that?
Intel's hyper-threading white paper is good, but largely just turn it off. Unless your application uses a large variety, like a large portion of the ISA, you're not going to see too much advantage from it. Because hyper-threading only works if, let's just say you've got a vectorized thread going through some SSE and some floating point. Those two can operate at the same time because they use different parts of the core. That's what hyper-threading is. It's just making use of more of the discrete components of a CPU at the same time. So if you're running highly vectorized integer stuff, you're not going to see any benefit. If you're all floating point based, same deal. And that's exactly why you'll see database servers saying turn off hyper-threading, because it will perform worse with hyper-threading on for that kind of compute load.
I would suggest you take a look at Intel's parallel programming website, which, I mean, granted, it's going to be highly Intel-biased, but if you're okay with that, they have decent tutorials and a lot of good resources that are specific to topics like, you know, under what circumstances will hyper-threading help? What are the gotchas? Like, what do you have to watch out for in parallel programming in order to not have, you know, all your cores stop at the same barrier simultaneously? I don't know that it necessarily will cover, basic... Well, they have videos and webinars under the New to Parallel Programming heading. So obviously they've got some introductory stuff as well as the expert level stuff. So whatever it is you're after, they'll have something. And if that's a resource you haven't checked out, it'd be worth looking into.
Under Java, some had some good tutorials for threading within Java. Mm-hmm. So that helps
you all. I thought that hyper-threading was where you take a snapshot of all your registers and maybe a little bit of localized memory and so forth, and then you work on some other process, and then it just jumps back and restores the original to what it was before?
Nope.
That's context switching, and that happens totally anyway. Okay. Wasn't crazy with standard.
So I'm trying to learn about hyper-threading, and I still haven't got a clue.
Just give up and let the compiler do it. It's not worth it.
Mostly, yeah.
Did you say you're using it on Mac?
Yeah.
Are you using it with Apple, or are you...
Yeah, I'm using it with Darwin.
Okay. I mean, Apple has some pretty good stuff for you. I don't even know if multi-threading would be accurate. I guess they call it multi-threading, but multi-processing in general. They've got some really nice features even built into the C language.
I noticed what happened was initially there was a wow factor when I first bought my Apple, and then sort of after a while I thought, well, what else is there to it? But then the more that I learned about it, the more I appreciate it, truly. But the thing is, sometimes it's hard to find the stuff you need to know. I go to the Genius Bar sometimes, and if you ask them about parallel programming, they say,
I don't think you're going to get very far.
Is that two people programming at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you see Sheldon then? So there's some really cool stuff that you've done. Like, you can use closures in C and just ask them. You can just put them in a queue and have them run on different threads. So you don't even have to track which threads things are running on. There's some really, really nice features.
I know.
I've played with them a lot, played with them a little bit.
They have some
So if you're trying to get some performance, you can really you can really get all your ports working. So sure.
You're using Derwin, but are you using the Xcode development suite?
Yeah.
Okay, because with Apple and Xcode, they've got samples. And have you checked out the sample code for all the stuff? Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that had errors in them?
No, everything that they have works the way it's supposed to. But when I went to look about parallel threads on the internet, and I looked at other sites, including IBM, which is really reliable, but I don't know if this was like post 9/11 sort of thing where there's always some little mistake, so it doesn't run, and you have to sort of put two things together and then sort of figure out, oh yeah, in context, if this works here, then this would work there, and finally you get something to work, and
might be just that it's very specific for each system.
Finding stuff on the internet is
very difficult. It works for their computer.
Exactly.
And IBM has theirs, and it works on theirs.
Yeah, they use the
stick with Apple.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more Mug Meetings summaries, or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.